Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
And welcome to the Sun Cinema Podcast, a weekly radio show that examines the highs and lows of the medium of film through the filtered lens of Washington, D.C.'s only privately owned arthouse cinema. I am your host, Jason Cauley, and I'm joined by my co-host and the proprietors of Sun Cinema, David Cabrera and Ryan Mitchell. Gentlemen.
Hey, Jason.
What's up?
Hi, how you doing?
Oh, we're alive.
Yeah, we're
waking up.
We're alive, and we're coming to you live from the Full Service Radio Station inside the glorious Line Hotel here in the Adams Morgan neighborhood of our nation's capital. We have a special treat for you today. We have a guest, Don Langford. Hi, Don.
Hey. Oh, my God. Is this like a morning zoo? Should we get zany?
This is basically Z-Zoo.
A little bit. Yes. Don's an independent documentary producer and curator. She recently completed documentaries called Check It, Kandahar Journals, and Seeing Joseph I. Her next documentary is in early production and will be Don's directorial debut. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Can you tell us just a snippet about the documentary you're directing?
It's about a public intellectual, Amitai Etzioni.
Okay.
So he escaped Nazi Germany in childhood, and now he is the founder of the Communitarian Movement. Huh. And he's D.C.-based, and he has been for a while.
Oh, wow. All right.
And that's all I can tell you.
Great. No, that's cool. Thank you.
That's all
we eagerly wait.
Yeah, that sounds dope.
Same
yeah, what's here. Your, I mean, any kind of timeline? I know it's early on.
No.
Okay. Yeah, fair
early,
enough.
Fair enough. Early stages.
Yeah, waiting on permits.
Yeah,
on
I'm going to go home and keep editing.
Cool.
How's everyone's weekend? Did anybody watch the Super Bowl? Film nerds, did any of us watch the Super Bowl?
I actually watched the second half of the Super Bowl.
I did not.
Svetlana got tired and went to bed, my wife, and so I just flipped it over to see what all the fuss was about, watched some commercials, saw a Keanu Reeves commercial, which like made my night.
That one was like pretty cool. I can't remember what it was for.
Squarespace, I think.
Oh, okay. I was like, it's not for motorcycle. He was on a motorcycle the whole time.
Yeah, it should have been for a motorcycle.
Is it reminiscent
motorcycle.
Of The Matrix?
No, not.
No, it was just kind of cool. It was just like him riding on a motorcycle going faster and faster and looking cooler and cooler.
Yeah. So I don't know if I'm just like way more cynical of like advertising and capitalism. Even as a kid, I thought that was bullshit, but I would think some of the ads were kind of fun.
Right.
I swear, I watched the whole damn thing. The ads were the worst. Like, honestly, they were like trying to tap into certain things and they just clearly weren't getting it.
Oh, there was definitely a movement of like, we're all in this together, America, and we're all for each other, America. And
as a platitude,
okay. I heard they used Martin Luther King to sell a car.
You missed
they
it.
Did.
I've
oh
only heard
God.
Talk about it on the radio.
They did.
Oh, it's unreal.
Yeah.
It was so rough.
Which car commercial was
for
it?
For a Dodge Ram.
At that point, my wife had walked back through the living room where this was on, and she's like, is this really happening? Is this what they're doing? Are they using a speech by Martin Luther King?
It was
jaw
dropping.
I was like, that's exactly what they're doing.
Yeah.
Someone put together they took the same commercial and took
the same sermon,
same speech, same sermon. And it's like him critiquing capitalism and
advertisers
and advertisers
for the Dodge Ram.
Dodge Ram. Someone took parts of that same speech and put it over the Dodge Ram commercial. There was more of like, you need to feel better about yourself by having a better car than your neighbor and all this stuff. It was
Should
great.
We set this place on fire now?
I've got I brought a Dodge Ram today, actually.
So, it's in the parking lot.
It was a great way to usher in Black History Month. It was really, they were showing
just
that they cared.
You want it to
no,
happen.
I swear to you, I'm almost positive the speech was from 50 years ago that
to
day.
The day.
To the day.
To the
February
day.
4th.
That's called Black Magic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
exactly.
Turns out he's good for sales, he's good for a lot of things.
We need to take the legacy back.
Yeah, well,
from okay. Dodge Ram.
Yeah, so I guess that brings us to the month, Do the Right Thing. You know, we wanted to be mindful if we were just exploiting Black History Month the same way the Dodge Ram was. The way, you know, when we were trying to think of, like, should we program a month of Black cinema, Black films, like, yeah, just, that was a fear for us.
Just in case anybody's kind of listening to this wondering what we're talking about.
Okay.
Sons, oh, yeah, we should.
Sons did an
we're
entire...
Cinema. So, we're a cinema. Yeah,
there's a physical cinema of Sons Cinema in Mount Pleasant here close by in D.C., and they programmed the entire month with some help from Dawn and a couple of others to set up kind of a Black History Month. And it kind of begs the question, and I believe one of the documentaries begs that very question of, what is Black History Month? Is it really doing what we want Black History Month to do? Is it enough? Why is the shortest month of the year also Black History Month?
And coldest.
The coldest month of the year.
Yeah, well, it could be seen as a little bit of an insult. And also just separating Black history from American history. That's not really ideal, but we still have problems around representation.
Right.
I do think that if you utilize Black History Month correctly, it can at least help more people not only see themselves on screen, more accurate representations, more accurate historical information. And Black liberation equates everyone's liberation, in my opinion.
Right.
So we should all embrace it.
Yeah. So I think we wanted to talk a little bit about some of the films you selected and why, in particular, maybe some of those films were selected.
There you go. There's a thank there's you. Our calendar.
I need notes.
And if you want to look at this calendar, you can find it on suncinema.com, kind of.
Kind of, yeah. Or
go ahead, plug.
Instagram, suncinema, S-U-N-S, cinema. Facebook, the same.
Yeah.
Twitter. What are the other ones?
Twitch.
I don't know. Twitch.
On Twitch.
We're on Twitch. Twitch. Just email reservations at the Lion Hotel if you're interested in our calendar. Right.
They'll send it to you.
So yeah, Don, tell us about our calendar.
Well, I have to say, it really came about just from having conversations with David. I enjoy hanging out at the Sun Cinema. It's become essentially my hangout. It's our community center. I can go there, I can have an intelligent conversation, it can be film based or not, or I could not have an intelligent conversation.
That's also true.
And just have a good time. David was concerned about a lot of how to do the programming. It's definitely still something to be embraced, and I'm glad that they didn't just gloss over and decide not to have a conversation or just not to program it in this way. And also to invite input from community members, I think, is really incredible. And secretly, I want Sun Cinema to also be more of a hub for the independent filmmakers in the area.
Us too.
Yeah.
So
totally.
So I'm trying to also,
it's a win-win.
Kind of keep doing that. So yeah. I just sent him some stuff, and Dave went through it, and more than a month kind of launches this month, where a very important question and an African-American filmmaker basically travels around the country having this conversation. It can be seen as a campaign against having a Black History Month, and, I don't think we're at the point yet where we can have less representation, but that's that.
In general, I mean, I think this is an obvious question, and hopefully we're trying to address it with our programming, but is there just a huge underrepresentation of people of color or a lot of voices in film and media? I mean, is that one of the things that we need to break down?
Merp. Yeah, definitely.
I'm leading you in.
Yes, of course. I could speak to that, and just as a African-American filmmaker and a woman, I'm definitely not seeing any reflections of myself. Not that I watch cinema to see my reflection, but the most powerful thing is to have a first-person narrative. And so that helps people empathize and see your point of view, and that's liberating. And so for me not to have that representation of that firsthand narrative is not helpful. So I think, that's, I'm pushing for that.
and many other people are too.
So what were a couple other things that you were pushing for the month?
You know, I've been bugging Dave to play I'm Not Your Negro for a while, just because. And I think everyone so should good. See it. And it's so, so well done. It's really beautiful. I mean, I'm excited about all the films on Thursday. Through a Lens Darkly, people don't realize that the power of the image, and that black photographers, African Americans, understood that image, the visual nature, and taking that back has a lot of power.
Right.
So that's pretty well demonstrated in that film. And then Let the Fire Burn is from a local filmmaker, Jason Oster. And I met him probably over 10 years ago when he was working on Let the Fire Burn. And it's about the move, what happened to Move, which was an African-American in Philly. Yeah. So, I mean, basically the police just dropped bombs on them. And then, you know, the place just went up in flames. And Jason was very careful about, he's white, and he's been working on this for years, very carefully crafted all archival footage to kind of flesh out what happened.
Right.
This happened in the early 80s.
And is he going to do a Q&A?
He's doing an intro and a Q&A on Thursday.
That'll be awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's been a great night.
Yeah.
I've seen a few other random things people have built around it, stories people have made about it, but it seemed from interviews I've seen with him, I haven't seen the movie yet, that he's, like you said, he's trying to use archival footage, not tell too much of the story, but use existing info to let it tell the story.
It's very important to have, especially when you're telling a history, to not have this authoritative voice that's separated from the experience.
Or just like a singular person, as in like a newscaster who's like, here's why you should care about the story going on behind me. It's always
exactly
a little messy.
Yeah, or just through also just this like, you know, he's not taking any stance, but just letting it play out for itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so hugely important too. And I think there's a disconnect sometimes in documentary where it is kind of a filtered voice. And you lose some of the idea that while I understand you're talking about real life events, we are still in we still are coming to a cinematic experience.
Yeah, or and if that's you look at Michael Moore,
You know, we can have conversations, we can have radio programs like this where you can get other people's voices, understand the history and everything. But when I sit down in a darkened room, I want to see a movie at the end of the day. You know, that's what I'm doing. And the more that can be cinematic, the more that can be that type of experience versus someone dictating to me facts and figures and maybe pushing an agenda, whether it's the right agenda or not, doesn't matter. But just to let something unfold naturally and walk away, you know, with a bigger conversation, I hope.
Yeah, it's experiential.
Right.
That was hard to say.
No, that was good.
Yeah.
Existentially experiential.
Experiential. Okay, got it.
We'll end on that
today. also, there's a couple that you worked on. Or should we save that for later? Should we come back and talk about some of the stuff that you've been working on specifically?
Well, you know, I'm ready to plug anytime. LOL.
Jack, what are you thinking?
Let's take a quick break.
Let's take a breather. All right. We're going to breathe and we're going to talk to Don about what's happening.
Today's tune's courtesy of a producer named Kido, K-I-E-D-O. That's soundcloud.com/Kido. We'll be right back on the Sun Cinema Podcast. Stay tuned.
And welcome back.
I think we're welcome.
Are we welcome back?
Yeah.
All right. Welcome back to the Sun Cinema Podcast. We have a very special guest today in Dawn Langford, and we're talking to her about some of the projects she's done and some of the projects that are coming up in her life. And Yeah. Dawn, I mean, tell us a little bit about what's going on with you. And
thank you. I appreciate that.
Plug away.
Check it. Should we start off?
Or let's
finish the movies.
There's two other things that Dawn helped program and helped create. Right?
Yes. Well, I didn't help create The Nine Lives of Marion Barry, but I always pushed that film. I worked with Dana Floor and Toby Oppenheimer on Check It, just initially as someone that was helping them organize their years of shooting, and then it just kept growing to the point where I was editing some of the selections and helping in multiple ways. So,
and what is Check It?
Check It's a documentary about African-American gay gang in Washington, D.C. And I hate using the term gang, but they basically just started to defend themselves from violence, whether it's in the community or anywhere.
Just a natural kind of coalition coming together of the homosexuals who were felt threatened?
There were like two or three who were in middle school, and they're like, let's just fight back.
All right.
It's a pretty awesome film.
It's pretty organic.
Yeah. And so Dana and Toby spent 7 months with them prior to even filming, just to establish relationships and trust.
Right.
This film premiered at Tribeca. It was a dream come true for me to have kind of a producer's role on a film debuting there. I was sitting next to Fab Five Freddy.
Cool.
Blondie was sitting there. Cool. And, you know, before Louis C.K., became a monster, he was there. And, you know, it was really exciting for me.
No kidding, yeah.
But the film itself has been pretty life-changing, and it gave me the courage to keep just doing, just like staying in culture and just be brave and, only work on creative things.
Well, and maybe you can speak to this a little bit, but these projects, I mean, you were talking about, Let the Fire Burn, a decade-long project, you know. Some of these things I can tell just by...
A documentary can eat your life.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Know if I even recommend it to anyone.
Okay, that's where I was headed.
You have to really be passionate about what you're doing to do it.
Well, I know. I mean, there's so many things where... you just run out of steam, and to find your way through a documentary over years of effort, that there is some level of tenacity there that I think has to be part of who you are.
Yeah. And the money's got to be so good.
The money's so good. So that's probably what keeps you, but
yeah.
Tuck, can you talk about funding a little bit and kind of how,
I've run more than my share of crowdfunding campaigns.
Okay.
And it's not fun, but you have to do it. And now it's become a standard. So even if you do have funders, if you have a production company,
you're still doing
they want you to be able to prove that people are willing to invest.
Sure,
so even if you have, money and you've gotten some grants, some of it is contingent on how you can
crowdsource the rest.
Crowdsource and market.
I think the Lion Hotel was entirely kickstarted.
Right. That's true, actually. Yep.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. No, I mean, to me, though, that's hugely important, and it is a huge barrier to entry, obviously, but there's so many things about documentary filmmaking that just astonishes me when you see one, A, that's well done, but even one that just gets done. When you start unpacking all the things that went into getting that
absolutely
to the screen.
I'm really excited that I worked with Dana and Toby. They produced The Nine Lives of Marion Barry, and so many people only think of that moment in the 90s or the late 80s when he was caught in that hotel room, and he has a legacy. I mean, his entire life is incredible.
Yeah.
And for it to be distilled constantly, like, oh, you mean the crack mayor?
Right, right.
It's really frustrating. So I always encourage people to see The Nine Lives of Marion Barry. It's really riveting because you're just like, no, don't do that. Or, right. Oh, my God, he did so many things. And you really understand more about D.C. home rule. And so people that are new to D.C., I think, would really find this interesting, just learning about how we didn't have home rule for so long, yeah. and that there's still, and still to this day, there's a lot of federal intrusion on just being able to have rights to spending, having our publicly elected officials. You know, we still don't really have representation. All of that is covered in the Nine Lives of Marion Barry.
Yeah, I think people in D.C., you know, or outside of D.C., just looking at that as an example of the as a historical document of nothing else, and compare that to what's going on in their city.
Yeah, well, you know? And it's not a dry documentary. Dana and Toby really get in there. They, like, she spent days and days, like, they're in the car together, they're dancing, they're hanging out. Like, it's cool. Really personal. It's so you also get to know him in this documentary.
Nice.
Yeah.
Did they go into his parking? I remember he was just hilarious when he was still around. He would just park wherever and just amass them.
Yes.
I'm like, that's a cool move.
Yeah. I always thought that was great. I mean, you want to, like, hang out with him.
Yeah, he's Marion Barry. Yeah, yeah. You can come party in Adams
and
Morgan.
He is cool. I've hung out with him a couple of times, and he's pretty cool.
Still a cool guy.
Yeah. Well.
Well.
R.I.P.
Yeah. Yeah. That's,
well.
Are you still? Wait.
Yeah.
And then for your next film, your directorial debut, I guess you don't want to talk anymore about that.
Oh, yeah, I can't.
That.
Yeah, it's okay. the rules of attraction, so yeah, I can't talk too much about it.
Fundred Reserve. This is another project you're co-producing on and helping out in D.C.
Yeah, so.
And can you tell us a bit about Fundred?
Sure.
Do you want to?
No, I definitely do. Okay. I love talking about Fundred. I always try to find better ways to talk about it because it's very strange and nuanced. Like, you'd make your own money, and it's to stop lead poisoning. Like, everyone's like, what does that mean? But I started working with the Fundred Reserve crew about a year ago when there was the Fundred Reserve exhibit that came with the visiting artist Mel Chin at the Corcoran. So I joined that team as DC coordinator, and I just wanted to do what I could to connect DC more with the Fundred project. It's been happening for over 10 years, and it's really just around the democratic, I guess, I don't know, just like getting people a little bit more passionate about eradicating lead poisoning. There's many youth and disproportionately black and brown children that have really high lead levels, and that it's a neurotoxin. So just even one exposure of high lead toxicity is going to heavily decrease IQ, motor functioning. Like, it's just going to change their entire lives. So through creativity, you know, we want to use creativity as a way to mobilize people, and then also make children understand that they have a voice, and their voice is also important. So,
well, it's also linked to birth defects, all these other things.
Yeah, no, and there's, you know, crime statistics.
Sure.
Well, and the little dollar bills are actually quite fun. They're just kind of blank dollar bills you just get to write
or draw. Right, well, they're $100 bills.
Oh, well,
hence
damn.
The Fundred.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, I mean, it is engaging, though. I saw a bunch of, you know, hipsters getting all excited to scribble on these things and draw cat photos and whatnot onto dollar bills that then later get sent to representatives to continue to keep them aware of the lead problem.
Yes.
Right?
We have 500,000 so far, and we are engaging with the arts community.
Half a million times
Fundreds.
100? Okay.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for that. Math
we
is
should
hard.
Do that math. That'll sound very...
I know, right? How many dollars? So it's an ongoing project. They've partnered with so many different institutions. Milchin has... he's going to be at the Queen's Museum with not a retrospective, but just more of a survey. And so many of the funders will also be there, and they'll also be featured during Open Engagement, which is an arts convening that really focuses on social practice. So I have a curatorial practice, and now it's kind of going into that direction where it's kind of merging activism with art, but within that framework of social practice.
How can people find out more about this? So
the Fund Reserve Open Lab is an initiative that I started just by talking to folks at the H Space, which is provided to us by Hamiltonian artists. So the Hamiltonian Gallery have a space that they intend to continue using in this way, or in some other ways too.
Like, but right behind like 9th and U, where it's in that alley,
yeah,
right?
It's in the alley. It's also 9.5 Street. Even though I just found out the hard way that you can't have things shipped to 9.5 Street.
Really?
Apparently it doesn't really exist, so I have to go to the post office after this. But anyway, I digress. We've got a lot of programming. We're inviting social practice artists to come and talk about their practice. We invited a scientist who is also all of our mutual friend to give us the big picture on lead from an earth science perspective.
Right, right, right.
You know, we've had a lot of programming. We had Critical Exposure, a nonprofit organization that empowers youth through creativity, training them to use photography as a way to amplify their voices. You can go to fundred.org or fundred.org/openlab.
Thank you. You were just talking about getting teens to use photography to bring up important issues to them. That was the Critical Exposure, right? Okay. So you were telling me about them this morning, and that's just generally kind of reminding me of, like, when you hear filmmakers who kind of just made a low-budget film that cracked in the beginning. They're just like, we just brought a camera around, started focusing on little stories we were seeing. I'm trying to think. Chan is missing. Blanking on the name of the director. But that director...
Wayne Wang. Yeah.
Saw him do a Q&A over maybe a year ago in LA. And what his advice was to local filmmakers, any filmmakers, was just get out there and shoot. Don't worry about the budget. Maybe get the budget later and shoot it again. But just shoot. Keep on trying to tell the story. Get it made. And I think if we're encouraging... Well, this is what I think. If we're encouraging young people to start telling stories that they're running into on their own lives with a camera or with a cell phone, with whatever, we're just going to have better art discourse
and better
through
representation.
Art.
I just watched last night the Michael Haneke film, Happy End. The only reason I bring this up is because the entire intro is shot on an iPhone. And he specifically shot it on an iPhone to show people, like, hey, here you go. You can make a film.
You can do this.
Get your friend to do a light assist with his iPhone on the side, you know?
Yeah, no, so is Tangerine.
Yeah, of course, Tangerine. Yeah.
Yeah,
the embodiment of an example of, the iPhone movie, you know?
Did they work on Florida Project?
Yeah, same crew. I don't know that it was Florida Project iPhone based. I don't think it was.
No, but same crew.
Yeah, so this is now filmmaker who gets to go make films because he took initiative and shot a film on an iPhone, you know?
I believe someone who worked on Florida Project is also working on one over in Anacostia right now. I believe is East of the River. Is this sounding familiar? Has anyone heard about this?
I'll have to Google it. I'm intrigued.
Right there with you. I am intrigued.
So I believe someone who worked on Florida Project is now, I don't know to what degree they worked on that, is now working on a film called East of the River. I'm going to find out more about it before I even talk about it.
No,
we can edit this
good,
out,
though.
Jack, in case I'm incorrect. But hopefully we can have her on open this discussion, unless it's going to be a crap movie. Then we won't.
If it's awful, we're not doing it.
Yeah, if it's...
Edit the sound.
We have a real high bar here. I think we showed Ace Ventura like 3 weeks ago. So what else? What else is next? Fundraise. Critical Exposure.
Critical Exposure.
Your documentary you can't talk about.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I like the idea of also encouraging people to get out there and make their own art and make their own movies and maybe not have to use the lens of social media. So maybe a lot of that energy is just kind of being sucked into Instagram stories.
I agree.
Instead
I think
of
there is...
creating something longer form. Do people even have the patience to watch a movie? Do you guys feel like, do you ever have audience members come in and just sort of get restless because the movie's so long?
Yes.
Well, but I think also on the flip side of that is I find myself having a much harder time getting through a movie at home now. So if I really want to focus on something, pay attention, start to finish, get the whole experience where you're kind of sucked into it, it's better just to go to a cinema because then I'm embarrassed to be on my phone. I won't pause it.
Right.
I mean, we pause it halfway so at our cinema. Yeah,
yeah. Out of shame.
But
it's like putting a record on in the same way where, you know, you can skip around music or you can put a record on. You'll be forced to listen to something that you weren't going to listen to otherwise.
Right. Yeah. But so maybe the Instagram story is also a good thing. I'll try not to be. I don't look at them, but I'm going to try not to be a curmudgeon who's thinking like, oh, these young kids don't know what they're doing. What if the Instagram stories ends up being like the best facet for discourse?
And it might
and
be
creative.
Yeah, it might
filmmaking.
Be an interesting narrative device too.
But it's also good to have the long format. I think both are really useful in trying to achieve whatever cinema or cell phone footage.
You made me think that. I've had some screenings, and depending on the audience, the feel of the movie is different, or the perception of the movie is different. So when screening Kandahar Journals at the National Gallery of Art, it was seen as an art film, and it very much was meant to be seen through that lens. But then we're seeing it at a college where there's all of these master's students in policy. And they're seeing it through a completely different lens.
That's great.
And you can feel it. And you're just like, oh, my God, this is a different feel now. An audience can really affect, I think, just our general perception when we're watching, when we're taking in media.
Yeah, I think that's huge. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago, just about the effect the audience has on the film and on the filmmakers. If, like in your case, when you're sitting there watching something you've created, you know, happening there, when you get that kind of visceral feel in the room, I mean, it just heightens the entire experience.
It does. It's weird when you've looked at something over and over again in an editing process, and you know a person so well, even though sometimes you've never even met them, and then you're sitting in a room watching it with other people. It's a weird
sensation.
You
suddenly see everything that they see or you perceive they see.
Yeah.
Yeah, or you just get a strange wave of like a different, like you're not even seeing it through your own eyes.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. I love that. Yeah. That's nice.
So creepy. That's
great. Should we get into the Super Bowl?
Yeah, well, let's take another break and then let's start. If you are listening to the Sun Cinema podcast right now and you don't listen to anything else, the Eagles just won a Super Bowl. We're going to talk about Philadelphia football and movies in a couple minutes.
Philadelphia, here we come!
Flip, Philadelphia!
Yeah!
All right, that's like the soft version of what has been Philadelphia for the last couple of days. If anyone's paid attention, they've been raucously enjoying their their Super Bowl victory this past weekend.
That's recent footage right there you're listening to.
Yeah. Jesus.
All right.
God. So since we're probably not the people to talk about Tom Brady's fumble or his amazing pass yardage or any of that, blah, blah, blah.
You did good there. That was good.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had 500 yards.
Two things.
Yeah, he was good, right? So we paid attention to a couple things. But let's just talk about football, movies. Anyone like them, hate them?
I will tell you, just kind of going back through that, when we started, you threw that out there a few days ago, like, hey, what about football movies? There's not a lot. There's Waterboy. I mean, we can. Here's the thing, though.
The
whole
10 yards.
Yeah, I went to T.C. Williams, and there's a movie about T.C. Williams.
Remember the Titans.
Absolutely. The Titans.
2000, yes. I think, yeah.
I never saw it.
Oh, it's actually quite good.
Does Jerry Maguire count as a football movie?
Yeah, sure. I'd say. Yeah.
Sure, yeah. No, I mean, that's the thing, though. You start very quickly getting into, like, does Ace Ventura count as a football movie? Because it's the Miami Dolphins.
Yeah.
We Are Marshall. We Are Marshall.
We Are Marshall, for sure. There's a great film in 1979 by a guy named Todd. Is it Todd? Ted? Ted Kotcheff, called North Dallas 40.
Okay.
That's basically about the life and times of football players in the late 70s and just kind of the pre-big contract era of the 80s and stuff like that, and how these guys were just kind of used and abused. But also, yeah, this was like, yeah, pre-concussions. Dudes are, you know, I mean, it's not a documentary.
When they were tougher guys.
Yeah, but it's not a documentary, but there are some documentary type of elements to it where you start seeing, like, gosh, these guys really just – like had some led wild crazy lives and just were old men by the time they were 35, you know, old and broken.
That's why I don't play.
Nick Nolte's in it. It's actually a great performance by Nolte, and, oh, cool. And it's the one I would say. And then of course there is Invincible from 2006, which has all the Philly ties that you want. It's about, you know, a real life story based on a real life NFL player, Vince Papale.
He was a bartender, right?
Who was a bartender in 1976.
It could still happen.
Still, yeah, do the sport.
Went to open tryouts for the Philadelphia Eagles and made the team, you know?
Yeah.
Local legend kind of guy, which was a nice tie-in for the Marky Mark Wahlberg. Played Vince Papale.
Yeah, that's probably all we got. Oh, Showtime played Any Given Sunday on Sunday. I thought that was pretty cool. Instead of playing Super Bowl, just played... Like a movie Bowl about football. Movie. Is it a Super Bowl movie?
Well, I guess just a football movie. Just a football movie with Al Pacino as a head coach.
Friday night.
Nothing about that movie makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Can I ask a dumb question?
Yeah.
Sure.
Why do people get so riled up about the football?
About the football?
The football. The football game.
Well,
the
aside from game, training people to be nationalists.
Yeah.
I just want to understand.
I don't know that we're going to answer that question today. I would say, you know, it has a lot about
it ties
living.
In with pride, though, right?
Yeah,
like pride of your where you live,
for
your
sure.
City.
There's also just a vicariousness of sports in general, specifically with men, but I think it's become adopted by women, specifically in football for some reason. But yeah, there's some vicariousness, you know, that applies there. Yeah.
My friend, she was. Due to go to Philly, and she didn't know that it was the Super Bowl even. Found out that it was the Super Bowl while she's going, like taking a train there, she's like, oh no, I don't want to make them lose. And that there is this belief that if somebody that's not from there all of a sudden arrives, that it's going to throw their opportunity.
I was a high school athlete and played baseball, and baseball is by far like the most cross your fingers, don't do this, don't do, you know, just completely superstitious. So I can kind of sympathize with her a little bit because I still do that kind of stuff.
So she turned around.
So she didn't go.
She went right into the riot. No.
But there aren't a ton of great football movies.
Did someone say Little Giants?
That's the only thing we could think of yesterday. Little Giants. That's the only one.
Perfect.
There's other football movies.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of bad ones, and there just aren't that many good ones. There are some good Philly movies.
There's a bunch of good Philly movies.
Yeah, and the more you dug into it, the more you realize, like, oh, yeah, there are some, like, filmmakers like M. Night Shyamalan, who basically sets everything in Philadelphia, you know, who's kind of making that in the way that Spike Lee or Martin Scorsese do that for New York. He is truly a Philly guy and has created an entire universe of characters and films that exist inside or around Philly, you know. Obviously,
The
Sixth Sense being the first one that, you know, kind of launched that. But even the latest Split, which ties back into his kind of own
mythology
that he's created, it was all set in Philly as well. And of course, you know, right off the bat, everybody thinks two films, Rocky and Philadelphia, right? Like, that's, if you said, give me movies about or set in Philadelphia, the two things that come to mind are Rocky and Philadelphia. But Dave, I'm not going to take it.
No, you can take it.
Well, the first one I thought of when we watched the Philly movies.
I had to look it up to find that out, so I feel like... Did you know beforehand?
No, I double-checked because I had seen it recently. I mean, like in the last couple of years, and I remembered like, oh, that is in Philly. It's one of my favorite movies called Blowout, Brian De Palma film from 1981.
That movie, too.
Yeah, isn't it so fun?
It's pretty good.
And John Lithgow's so creepy in that movie. But also, you know, set in Philly and kind of shot all around the city, which is great. And then upon some digging, you realize, like, oh, Trading Places about the same time. I think it was 83. It's Philly-based.
So good.
And it holds up. Yeah, I mean, the first half of it especially just holds up so well.
The second half.
12 Monkeys.
Second half starts falling apart. 12 Monkeys, yeah. Terry Gilliam, yeah.
Kind of going to Philly.
Yeah.
No, it's definitely like that's where they're holding them, I think, is in Philly.
I was pretty psyched. I looked up like just good Philly movies. I think Time Out magazine had top 25 movies or something. Okay. And Move... or the one on Move, Let the Fire Burn, was in the top three.
Oh, nice.
Things you should watch. Yeah,
okay.
I believe it was Time Out. I'll find out what it was otherwise.
Beautiful.
Also,
it's a pretty well-celebrated film.
Yeah. I mean, but that's great that, even New York was able to recognize that this is a good Philly movie.
Aha.
We'd also be remiss. This is...
And next to Rocky. I mean...
hard to beat Rocky.
Hard to beat.
It didn't beat Rocky.
Proven.
But, I mean, it was up.
Proven.
There. It
was up several there. Films.
I was 25. It was
No.
Clubber got him.
Clubber. I love a Mr. T reference. Also, just somebody's going to say something if we don't.
Transformers:
mention it,
Revenge of the Fallen.
Well, there's that. I wasn't going to go with that, but I was going to go with Silver Linings Playbook, which is the David O. Russell film, 2012, which is also about the Eagles and the whole. Football
and wearing trash bags.
Wearing trash bags to go
going
running.
Manic, wearing trash bags.
Bradley Cooper
manipulating your friends because you're addicted to. Yeah, I kind of remember.
Yeah.
One I started watching yesterday, The Jungle. Anyone watch it?
It's like a
20-minute doc about street gangs, late '60s
in Philly.
The Jungle. Good. 1968-69. It's on YouTube. You can watch it.
Short doc. Love it.
I guess I can compare it mildly to Check It just because it has because it's like looking at a small, it's trying to look at kind of gang mentality or the gang culture without a judgmental eye, but just like.
But it's called The Jungle.
This is what it is.
But it's called The Jungle. But it's called The Jungle.
The six.
But I also think it's like kind of self-aware of it. It looks more youthful. Like when you're meeting all the characters, it's kind of more about youth and. Their perspective of it, and I think they're kind of aware of the jungle being. I think they're self-aware about that.
The '60s are strange because there's all the Mondo Kane series where they would explore things that are interesting, and it would have that immersive kind of we're here,
we're dropping you in the middle of this,
And I guess Vice has picked up where Mondo Kane left off, but.
That's an interesting analogy.
Actually. I'm just not sure how woke it is. Yeah. I'm still not sure, but
definitely,
it's not for me to decide.
What else we got? What else has happened in Philly?
The Master, it seems, was set in Philly.
Yeah, I saw that too.
No.
Oh, that's right. The Master was set in Philly. I don't know how much was actually filmed in Philly, but it was set there. You mentioned something the other that I didn't think was actually filmed in Philly, but as...
Oh, Mikey and Nikki?
No, not Mikey and Nikki, but I'm glad you brought that up because I love Elaine May, and I'll talk about Peter Falk and John Cassavetes forever. But
The Blob.
The Blob, yeah. Steve McQueen.
Yeah.
And 1958 version.
I love The Blob.
Yeah.
Everybody loves The Blob, right?
It's
you can't not love The Blob.
So apparently the one odd fact about it was they offered... Steve McQueen 10% of the earnings of the movie, and he turned it down for the $2,500 or whatever because they thought it would bomb. And then it became a summer blockbuster.
It was a summer blockbuster.
Got played for
years at drive-ins. Yeah, I mean, and on television for years. I can't tell you how many times St. Louis Channel 11, the midnight movie on Friday night is The Blob. It's guaranteed. Twice a year, it's going to be on.
Steve McQueen blew it. He could have had all that money. Whatever happened to him?
Poor guy.
The Blob is just sadness now.
Yeah.
It's a blob of sadness. Has anyone had anything happen to them in Philly that
that was kind of cinematic and strange, because it really is a strange town. I've been there a few times. It's strange.
I actually love Philly. I love going up there. I always have a hoot of a time. I went to the last time to the Penn or Eastern State Penitentiary, which I expected to kind of be like a woo spooky ghost tour through a old penitentiary. But you learn all these facts. It's narrated by Steve Buscemi, which is awesome.
Oh, that's cool.
That's my dude.
Tons of info on the skyrocketing rate of incarceration since the 1960s. I mean, the whole thing leads you through this cool kind of spooky look through the whole place and the process and how it was so influential around the world. But then it leads into this courtyard with like a 15-foot tall statue of the incarceration rates, who's affected by the incarceration rates, broken down by men, women, populations. Wow. So it ends up being a whole, we need to stop our prison industrial complex. It's a, I've never been happier that I gave money to enter anything than this place. Yeah. I mean, it really
that's
was.
That's so cool. That's
and
really
high
cool.
school kids go there for free. It was packed with kids.
Nice.
And they're all learning about kind of social justice in the prison industry. And then they just, didn't they just pick their new AG, Krasner, whatever? Their new attorney general in Philly? Just like fired a bunch
You're
of...
You're just full of facts.
Philly's cool. Though that guy's like a... He fired 30 people from... prosecutors out of the city that have been throwing people in jail for years. First day, I mean, it's coldest day of the year, and you see 30 people bringing their
Taking
things
their
out to their yard.
Out.
Yeah, just
cops. The police union did not endorse him. They endorsed a Republican over him. Yeah,
he's cleaning house.
He's cleaning house. And so there's actually Philly, despite recently being on fire, is actually a place I think where we can look to see. Hopefully,
they're just spirited.
Yeah, they're just spirited victors. But hopefully we can see some like good change in police policy and
some more good movies out of Philly, if that's the case as well.
Yeah, I think he specifically was going to bring Tom Hanks in to do movies for the next... None of this.
You had me excited for like 2 seconds. I was like, what is happening?
He's going to make Philadelphia 2.
Philadelphia 2.
Yeah. I had a boss from Philly... I used to do market research for films, and this guy was like a really eccentric millionaire, and he was from Philly, and I'm dating myself as far as how old I am, but
is this guy RIP or is he around?
I haven't been in contact, but we would have to go around Georgetown with these little like DVD players, and we'd show different versions of trailers for movies.
Oh,
and at the time, we were doing tests for Forrest Gump. So there were like four different Forrest Gump trailers, depending on what your demographic was. So there was one for, you know, males 18 to 30. And then there was like women 25 to 45. And they all had different music and like different kind of lies about the film. Like, it looked like a rom-com, and then it looked like this crazy adventure. And so anyway, that's what I did at the time in my early 20s. And he's like, you guys are doing such a great job. And he invited me and my friend to come stay with him for more training in Philly. And he had this strange mansion, and he didn't believe in electricity, and he had like candles everywhere.
This guy
and he was
like a
movie. And he was like reading this, you know, like reading prose to us at dinner, and it was just so insane.
And that's who develops the algorithms of how we watch movies. This character.
And I do think that whole marketing research around films unfortunately has shaped the way that films are being constructed, at least like larger films.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, so that's my Philly story, and it does tie in with movies a little bit.
Yeah,
yeah, that's insane.
Mine didn't.
It was, but we couldn't wait to leave.
Which is probably how you feel right now. I feel like now's a good time to jailbreak, right? Should we get out of here? Should we go have a flip cup competition?
I started to say we could totally do a flip
on the Liberty.
You read my mind.
All right. I guess, Jack, are we? Yeah, are we all done? Are we?
Big news, bitches!
Yeah,
ban's been lifted, and we are back in Flipadelphia. Here we come!
Flip Philadelphia. Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.